is a deep sense of shame in us. I want to be clear, shame itself is not an inherent virtue. But shame, in particular shame in the ecclesiastical sense, has a way of forcing contrition. And contrition, along with the redemptive qualities that accompany it, is a fundamental good in our society. It correlates virtue with a higher power, and that we will be judged according to that higher power. This is exceptionally important. Without a transcendent moral authority, what motivation would we have to live virtuously? Wouldn't we be able to justify just about any action taken? I'm not here to evangelize. I know that many people do not look to the Bible for their moral guidance or feel that famous sense of Catholic guilt. But consider the value in having an hour or two every Sunday to reflect on your wrongs. It is the same as training with a rifle or a compass or practicing with a basketball or 7-iron. It drills your conscience with a sense of shame, which becomes remorse, which becomes redemption, and ultimately self-improvement. To have no shame is to wrongly believe you are fine as you are, with no room to grow. It is a self-imposed restriction on further development. To fill a country like the United States with the shameless rather than the virtuous is to allow vice and iniquity to define us as a people and stunt much-needed progress. Shame is accountability. You may still decide to be a jerk and leave that trash on the sidewalk, but at least you felt a little bad about it. At least you felt some semblance of personal responsibility for failing to hit the gym 3 days in a row. You felt some regret for failing to check in on a friend you know is struggling. And it is this notion of personal responsibility that we are ultimately getting at. It's one of the most important concepts that make up the bedrock of a well-functioning society. Personal responsibility leads to empowerment, control, and ultimately, success. A person who isn't personally responsible and feels no shame for it is, by definition, waiting for someone else to be responsible for them. This isn't empowering. This is disempowering. Someone else has responsibility for you and therefore control over your destiny. This frame of mind, where you accept that others must be responsible in your stead, is a prison. It is the abdication of agency and control in your life. It is the height of helplessness, and I wish it on no one. A dose of shame is required for personal responsibility to manifest. After all, the fundamental desire to be responsible for your actions and destiny requires an intrinsic sense of right and wrong, good and bad, and therefore a sense of shame to help understand that choice. That sense of personal responsibility gives us control and leads us to other virtues that ultimately make us better and more productive people. It will give you a moral toughness that hardens your resilience to external and internal stress. Don't be shameless. Train your unconscious mind to feel bad. Work hard to define what is good and what is bad. Think deeply about your hero attributes. What are they? Why are those heroes successful? Why do we look up to them? And are you feeling a sense of shame every time you engage in a behavior that doesn't live up to that hero? A healthy sense of shame means you are less likely to be outraged and therefore less likely to be anxious, depressed, and neurotic. The road to mental toughness is paved with the knowledge that we don't always do what is right, but we are willing to take responsibility for it, humbly correct it, and be stronger as a result. A mind that cannot bend to admit wrongdoing is easily broken. Don't be breakable. Live with fortitude. Chapter 7: A Sense of Duty. Growing up in Katy, Texas, I was in the last generation before overprotective helicopter parenting came onto the scene. I think the demographers put me in the elder millennial category, a time frame where we grew up with analog but became adults in the digital age. I had to call my friends on landlines to make plans. We navigated without Google's help. We looked up movie times in the newspaper, not the Fandango app. The internet hadn't yet scared parents into protecting their child's every move. My parents didn't hover or monitor me excessively. I was allowed to explore the neighborhood, take risks, skin my knee, or fall on my face. And that's not a figure of speech. I came home with a black eye and a busted lip more than a few times. The 1980s and 1990s were a crime-ridden era compared to today. Gang violence was rampant in the Houston area. In 1981, Houston was proclaimed the murder capital of the United States, with 701 homicides. Today, despite a much larger population, that number fluctuates between 300 and 400. It's still too high, but it is also a reflection of a vast improvement in policing and society from then to now. A high murder rate was just the tip of the iceberg. Kids' faces showed up on milk cartons constantly. And yet, even in those empirically more dangerous times, parents let their kids walk to school, ride their bikes to their friends' homes, and play unsupervised. All without a cell phone tethered to their child. Unbelievable. Mom, Dad, forget Afghanistan. How did I ever survive childhood? But with that freedom came a scourge. The bullies. Walking home from school every day in the third grade, my friends and I began having issues with another group of older kids. Each day was a challenge as these tyrannical little jerks chased us down. They specifically targeted a friend of mine whom they knew they could take on without fear of serious retribution. They would yank on his backpack and toss him around, sometimes throwing him to the ground. One day, I had enough. I don't know what came over me. I was not a big kid, I never have been. I just had enough. As the bullies were doing as bullies do, I decided to charge. I extended my arms and drove them straight into the back of one of our tormentors, slamming him to the ground. I then sprinted away like I had just won the Olympics. The third-grade admixture of selfless sacrifice and pragmatic self-preservation was perfectly expressed in both my attack and my flight. Thus ended the scourge of bullying. None of this was particularly dramatic or much different than any other childhood story. I share this story because elementary school was the first time, in living memory, that I felt one of the most important things a person can feel, a sense of duty. It was, in retrospect, exhilarating. I felt a duty to protect my friend from harm and to stand up against an obvious wrong. I was also a good student. Why? Because I liked school and learning? Sort of, but not really. I was a good student because I felt a strong sense of duty to get good grades. Why? Because I felt shame if I got a bad grade. Why? Probably because it was imbued in me by my parents. Growing up, they simply highlighted the importance of academics, putting forth your best effort on the soccer field, and standing up for your friends. And not because of any transactional benefit to these good actions. Rewards or punishments were not necessary, only the satisfaction of accomplishment and, in the case of the bullies, righting a wrong. These actions were good because they were good. And my parents imbued in me a sense of duty to do that which has inherent value. This is duty at the most fundamental level. It is a sense that there are virtues and values in this life that should be pursued for the sake of virtue itself. We know deep down what those virtues are. We know we have a duty to clean our room, be patient, be polite, follow the law, get good grades, respect our parents, and so on. We know that. We don't always adhere to them, but we know them. And hopefully, we feel a degree of shame when we don't adhere to them. Shame and duty are closely linked. You must feel shame so that you act on your sense of duty. Duty is a positive result from the negative emotion of shame. A healthy sense of duty toward self-improvement, virtue, and responsibility for your loved ones must be pursued consciously. We have to remind ourselves of it constantly. If we don't, it is far too easy to rationalize selfish and irresponsible behavior, eventually shutting down any feelings of shame whatsoever for that bad behavior. When the shame is gone, it is pretty unlikely that a sense of duty toward higher and nobler purposes will ever materialize. This trade-off manifests in the small stuff, too. If you don't feel bad about littering, then you certainly won't feel a sense of duty to pick up the plastic bottles near the storm drain before they wash away into the ocean. Duty is ingrained in the human condition. Our great religions are essentially based on a sense of duty to love God and live well. We have a duty to not only survive in this world, but to pursue a higher purpose. We are here for a reason, and living for that purpose is our choice to make. It is the path to happiness. Many political institutions throughout history have also centered around duty, albeit in very different and interesting ways. The ancient Greeks believed in living for the sake of the polis, or the city-state. It was your duty to live for the city, for the community. Sometimes, as in the case of a hoplite or Socrates, it was your duty to die for it. In Rome, it was deeply ingrained in the citizens to live according to law and tradition, which was one reason the early Christians, who refused to revere the civic gods and rights, were persecuted. Communists believe in an even more extreme version of duty toward the state. In America, our duty, as our founders envisioned it, was to live virtuously so that the government could back off and simply protect our freedoms. The American sense of duty is the most enlightened version thus far, with the best results. Our American sense of duty is based on Judeo-Christian history and teachings. In the United States Capitol, on the upper walls of the House floor, where the House of Representatives votes and debates, are the relief portraits of lawgivers. The historical figures depicted are noted for their work in establishing the underlying principles of American law. The lawgivers are historically diverse, including Jefferson, Hammurabi, Gaius, and Sir William Blackstone, to name a few. There are 23 lawgivers in total. Here is the interesting part. All the renowned figures' reliefs are in side profile, except one. At the center of the northern wall, only one portrait relief faces forward, looking directly down at the Speaker of the House. That portrait is of Moses. It is easy to understand why. Moses received the Ten Commandments from God on Mount Sinai, providing humankind with the most basic rules governing our sense of duty to ourselves, to each other, and to God. In case you don't have them handy, here they are. Number 1, you shall have no other gods before me. Number 2, you shall make no idols. Number 3, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Number 4, keep the Sabbath day holy. Number 5, honor your father and your mother. Number 6, you shall not murder. Number 7, you shall not commit adultery. Number 8, you shall not steal. Number 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Number 10, you shall not covet. Even if you don't believe in God, these divine laws chiseled on stone tablets have an importance beyond theology. Divine law has long superseded human law. Indeed, human law draws most of its moral character from those 10 simple rules. And assuming you didn't pirate this audiobook, these commandments are also quite obvious to you. If you are hearing these for the first time, your first reaction may be one of incredulity. Why do I need these? I already know these things. I know right from wrong. I don't need the Bible to tell me that I should respect my parents and not murder people. I don't need Moses to explain to me that coveting my neighbor's belongings is bad. I am sympathetic to that sentiment. But we do have to consider an important question. Why do we know these things? Who taught us? Our parents? Our culture? And who taught them? Where did these truths come from? There has to be a history of teachings and traditions that led to this modern moment where all of us just happen to know that lying about your neighbor or cheating on your spouse is a bad thing. It isn't necessarily the case that humans naturally follow these laws if left to their own devices. In fact, it is quite obvious that we don't follow these commandments very well at all. Human history is a story about the struggle to follow these fundamental truths, the struggle to live with virtue in the face of our own dark side. People of all types, including those of religious faith, have struggled to live according to this sense of duty. After all, the word Israel literally means struggle with God. Moses receiving the Ten Commandments was a defining moment in the beginning of Western civilization, where our sense of duty to live virtuously began. Whether you believe in the first four commandments, which instruct deference before the Almighty, or not, the truth remains that commandments 5 through 10 have had a profound influence on what we consider to be virtuous rules to live by. So much so that we consider the Ten Commandments to be a basis from which we derive our modern laws, and place the relief portrait of Moses front and center in the House of Representatives, where we create our laws. Our founders designed our republic with the understanding that citizens would strive to live under these divinely inspired rules. They understood that freedom could be protected only so long as citizens had a duty to live responsibly. Recall St. John Paul II. He said, "We have liberty not to do as we wish, but to do as we ought." Government can enforce the law after it is broken, but citizens must still choose to first follow that law if we are to live free from chaos. A prosperous nation is one where citizens choose to follow laws for reasons other than threat of punishment. The law must be respectable if we are to respect it, and respectable law is based on timeless virtues such as the ones written in the Ten Commandments. Our religious history doesn't just provide us with our basis for law, it also establishes the foundations for how we should live beyond the reach of law. It is not illegal to covet, but it is well established as a negative quality. It isn't illegal to commit adultery, although it is under military law, but courts still punish you for it during divorce hearings. But more than behavioral guidance, religion has provided us with a deeper sense of purpose. This is the benefit of believing in a transcendent power greater than ourselves. The Ten Commandments are not debatable, as man-made laws are. They are simply true. And that sense of truth allows us to pursue virtuous living and act on our duties in this life. This, in turn, provides a path out of despair. Most studies show that suicide rates among religious people are lower than among the non-religious. The reasons for this are likely complex, but I believe one reason is a sense of meaning that is greater than ourselves. That higher meaning produces a sense of purpose. Without it, nihilism can infect the head and the heart, and with it a sense of emptiness, a sense of being lost. If we are truly just walking skeletons stuffed with meat and tissue, following the commands of our firing neurons, then what is the point of it all? Living with purpose and virtue is not easy, far from it. The default human condition is to avoid duty and honor and shame. Religion can be a real buzzkill here, as it instructs a soul that seeks comfort and pleasure to stop seeking comfort and pleasure, and instead pursue purpose. More and more people are leaving the church. Everyone may provide different reasons for abandoning God, but I'm going to assert that freedom to pursue pleasure without guilt or accountability is a critical element of this disconcerting trend. I understand that if you are agnostic or not particularly religious, the Bible may not be a powerful or compelling source of authority. You may not believe in it, but you cannot escape its foundational impact on our government, our society, and our institutions. I believe our modern-day outrage culture is partly due to a misunderstanding of what our duties and virtues are, where they came from, and why they are good. For the outraged, there are serious questions about whether or not many basic truths actually exist at all. The postmodernists driving this revolutionary thought question everything simply for the sake of questioning it. This isn't a surprising trend among young people, since the language of revolution is always romantic and idealized, and the youth are most susceptible to it. On small scales, this might be fine. It is part of every child's learning process to ask, why? But mix this childlike curiosity with extreme political passion and social media-fueled outrage culture, and you've got a pretty dangerous mix. You have a cultural trend that seeks to tear down anything traditional simply because it is old. Think of the parable about the fence in the forest. As you walk through the forest, you come upon a fence. It extends out in both directions, beyond what you can see. Its purpose is not obvious. Why is this fence here? I didn't see any property on either side. What is it fencing in or keeping out? The postmodern revolutionary simply says, tear it down. Its purpose is not immediately obvious, so tear it down. A more careful thinker says, let us investigate this further. Just because we can't immediately explain something's purpose does not mean it is not important. We should learn the history of the fence before tearing it down. Tearing down the fence results in a world where we throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm not saying all traditions are good or immune from criticism. Remember, we used to think women shouldn't vote. That was a bad, long-held tradition. We changed it, and thank God we have a political institution capable of making such a change. But the truth is that women's suffrage was always something that aligned with our most basic values. The problem wasn't our values. The problem was that we weren't living up to our foundational values or the Judeo-Christian history they were based on. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that women can't vote. Today, the results of questioning all of our traditional values are fewer marriages, contracting birth rates, the erosion of interpersonal relationships, and declining church attendance. Instead of believing in our duty to overcome adversity, the outraged postmodernists want you to embrace victimhood. In this new world, it is of higher virtue to be oppressed than it is to be self-reliant. The modern outrage culturalists want you to speak truth to power with an angry fist, instead of seeking out truth for the sake of truth itself. This results in a lot of incoherent yelling and screaming, but not very much thinking. The outrage world is one where bad behavior has become justified simply because you feel angry and passionate about something. Anger and passion are becoming substitutes for righteousness. Attitude and arrogance are becoming substitutes for sophistication. At a very basic level, this is a shirking of fundamental human duty and responsibility. A responsibility to what exactly? Politeness, open-mindedness, and grace, for starters. These are our duties to our fellow Americans, just the basics. If we lose those fundamental virtues, we lose our sense of unity. Without a sense of unity, under an umbrella of common values, this whole great American experiment unravels. This republic is rooted in the notion that a diverse people, perhaps more diverse than any nation in history, can only live together in liberty and prosperity if we share some common understanding of respect and decency. Again, the law can be enforced only after the fact. It can serve as a deterrent. Only we can choose not to break the law in the first place. And if we don't begin to see that living with virtue is more than just an aspiration, but also a duty, then we fall victim to anger, outrage, and discord. Duty is not just about others. It also begets a sense of self-worth and purpose. The story I told about moving the rocks on the ranch is an important lesson precisely because no one would have noticed if I hadn't done it. The ranch owner, unable to watch me continuously throughout the day, never would have been the wiser if my rock-moving efforts were subpar. It was summertime in Central Texas, after all, and it would have been understandable for a 13-year-old to slow down a bit. I could have gotten away with moving considerably fewer rocks across that fence line, but I didn't. Because my parents taught me that a strong work ethic is not just a means to an end, it is an end in and of itself. Living with duty is the pursuit of virtue because it is good, not because there is a reward at the end. That being said, the good news is this: there is most likely a reward at the end. But if your focus is only on the end reward, it is likely that your actions to get to that goal will be insufficient. This is where the connection to our main theme, mental toughness, comes into play. Let me explain it this way. If my attitude during BUDS was simply, "I am doing this only because I want to be a SEAL," then I don't think I would have made it. Even though that statement is objectively true, I mean, why else would you suffer so much? It doesn't capture the mentality of the men who do make it through the gauntlet that is BUDS. The mentality that is beaten with controlled violence into a student during BUDS is that high performance is expected for the sake of high performance. It has intrinsic virtue, independent of its utility toward an end goal. Instructors often point this fact out. They can't possibly observe everything we do. They remind us constantly that we could easily skate by and do the bare minimum throughout BUDS. We could put just enough effort into that 4-mile run to get barely under the time limit. We could glide through the 2-mile ocean swims instead of striving to beat our previous time. We could spend one less hour cleaning our room before an inspection and just accept the punishment for failing. Even with all that, there is a chance we'll still make it to the end of training and go on to become a SEAL. But such a path to quote-unquote success is no path at all. In the world of the SEAL teams, it is deeply discouraged. The known half-ass, the man who skates by, the man who treats the minimum standard as his maximum effort, is not a man we want beside us in a firefight. We want the guy who puts every ounce of effort into everything he does. Anything less is failure, even if technically the job still gets done. For instance, when assigning something as simple as organizing a training day on the shooting range, there is a difference between getting the job done and a SEAL getting the job done. One could easily fulfill the boss's orders by doing the minimum, ordering some ammunition, and booking a time slot at the range. Let everything fall into place after that. But a SEAL, who values a sense of duty, doesn't stop there. He prepares the ammo so we don't waste time pulling it out of boxes. He writes out a series of shooting drills. He prepares paper and steel targets for variety. He brings in some outside experts to critique our shooting. He has a plan for cleanup at the end and makes sure everyone knows what it is. A sense of duty is indispensable in combat, because the ultimate test will be on the battlefield, where your greatest fears come true and death surrounds you, begging you to join him. Walking across the fields of IEDs in the countryside of Afghanistan could occur only with the deepest sense of duty to mission, country, and teammates. We do it because our country asked us to. We do it because the mission is just and necessary. We do it because our teammates, our brothers in arms, will be there, and we can't let them down. The first friend I lost to the war was Lieutenant Brendan Looney, killed in Afghanistan in 2010. A star lacrosse player at the Naval Academy, an exemplary husband, and an inspirational leader, Brendan embodied everything SEALs think about when we examine a sense of duty. His favorite value statement was, "Be strong, be accountable, never complain." Sound familiar? He had a roommate at the Naval Academy whom I never met, First Lieutenant Travis Mannion. They are buried next to each other in Arlington National Cemetery. Travis was killed in action as well, 3 years before Brendan. Their somber but undeniably American story is one of duty, expressed beautifully by Travis's words, "If not me, then who?" When describing the importance of duty, that is one of my favorite phrases, "If not me, then who?" It isn't just applicable to joining the military. It applies to everyday life. If you won't help that homeless person get a meal, who will? Why is it someone else's job? If you care, if you really care, then why not take action? What is better, demanding that some kind of government action be taken to solve a problem, or getting a group organized and getting it done yourself? You might say both. And if you are that person doing both of those things, then good on you. If you are just doing the first thing, then you are just asking others to do what you won't do yourself. If not me, then who? Is someone else going to discover that next medical breakthrough, or are you? Is someone else going to clean up your mess at the food court in the mall, or should you do it yourself? Is someone else going to stay late at the office and put the finishing touches on that big quarterly presentation, or are you? Big things and small things alike are driven forward by a sense of duty. We have to consciously apply it to every aspect of our lives. It is the path to self-reliance, responsibility, virtue, and striving to be part of the solution instead of the problem. It is hypocrisy to bemoan outraged Twitter mobs and then be one of the comments deriding the character and intent of the person you disagree with. "Delete your account, Nazi, idiot," are not exactly examples of thoughtful discourse, no matter how much you feel your comments are justified and true. We have a sense of duty to be better, more polite, and smarter with our public disagreements. I'm not alone in thinking this. Recall President Obama's 2016 exit interview. "I think that I can have a polite dialogue with somebody who differs from me. And so, on the one hand, my advice to progressives like myself, and this is advice I give my own daughters who are about to head off to college, is don't go around just looking for insults. You're tough. If somebody says something you don't agree with, just engage them on their ideas." End quote. We have a duty to be tougher, tough enough to engage in ideas. We have a duty to our entire society to be not just resilient, but anti-fragile, as defined by Nassim Nicholas Taleb in his book, Anti-Fragile. To be anti-fragile is to be the embodiment of the timeless truth: what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. A resilient person can suffer through some punishment, but an anti-fragile person is made stronger by it. Duty is the pathway to self-improvement. It is applied to every aspect of your life, your kids, your spouse, your job, your own self-improvement. You have a duty to those relying on you, and you have a duty to be the hero that you imagined yourself to be in Chapter 2. You have a duty because you are alive, and you're alive for a reason. I've been asked before what message I have for my fellow veterans who are struggling. Many veterans get out of the military, a place where duty and purpose are part of everyday life, and they are shocked by the lack of meaning they now experience. They are wandering, aimless, their sense of mission vanished. They feel empty. They had a duty to their teammates, their country, and the mission. Now what is their duty? I would say that it isn't any different. Your duty is the same. You still have a duty to your teammates, but those teammates are your family, friends, and community. It is to your fellow Americans. As an American, you have a duty to contribute, even if it's a small thing. Make no mistake, there is no job that is undignified. Every small job is a contribution to your country. I'm not being facetious, and I say that with utmost sincerity. You are employed, productive, contributing, making money and spending money, thus contributing to the tax base and to a healthy economy. It may not be glorious, but it is a duty done. Don't want to be at the bottom forever? Then there is opportunity to master a small task, to show up on time, to be a good employee, to be noticed, and to be promoted. Many of our grandparents and great-grandparents started off in small, seemingly meaningless jobs. Every mission matters, even the small ones. And you have a duty to put the same amount of effort into the small things that you do into the big things. Because the small missions, done well, make up the big missions. It's your duty to recognize that. Every mission we did as SEALs was really a result of a multitude of smaller missions accomplished by individuals who did their duty. In every smaller cog in the machine, it would have been easy to dismiss the small mission as unimportant to the larger cause. Easy to say, I don't really need to put in the extra effort to this contingency plan because it's so unlikely we will have to use it. Yeah, sure, until you do have to use it and everyone's life is on the line. A mission to capture a terrorist cell leader seems simple from the outside. Get to a location and capture the guy. Simple enough. In reality, it's possible only because of many separate missions executed extremely well. And that is only possible because each of those individuals feels an inherent sense of duty to make sure that if there's a screw-up, it won't be because they were the weak link. On one of our more complex missions in Iraq in 2010, the duty of each team member could not be overstated. We had intelligence from our Iraqi partners that insurgents were using the rural region in central Iraq to hide out and plan attacks in the city centers. We wanted to investigate these remote locations along with them. Side note, even in 2010, our Iraqi partners were very reluctant to do any mission without us. Even though the threat was relatively low compared to the civil war of 2006 to 2007, the Al-Qaeda insurgency still scared the hell out of the Iraqis. They could see the writing on the wall. Without an American presence, the insurgents, hiding out in Syria, would blitz through Iraq again. And this was exactly what happened after we left in 2011. While the notion of patrolling to different locations on a map seems relatively simple, I assure you it is not. Once you start asking some basic logistical questions, the operation becomes pretty complex. How will we get there? How will you move around once you're there? On foot? Do we need to bring vehicles? What kind of air support will we have? Where will we hole up to spend the night? Our plan was to drive our LTATVs throughout the rugged terrain, talk to the locals, and cautiously check out some of the locations described to us by Iraqi intelligence. LTATVs are light tactical all-terrain vehicles, not much different from your commercial side-by-side ATV. To get the LTATVs there, we had to fit them in four CH-47 Chinook helicopters. In the movies, special ops teams just show up, get briefed on the target, and get on the mission. Hollywood doesn't show you how each one of those team members is in charge of an extremely important part of the mission. 95% of warfare is logistics. Someone is in charge of making sure each LTATV is fueled, maintained, and equipped for a three-day journey. Someone is in charge of scheduling the airlift and making sure we have an appropriate landing zone. Someone else is in charge of making sure we have primary, secondary, and tertiary communications customized for the LTATVs. They can't just throw a radio in the back. It has to be secured and accessible. The antenna has to be customized and attached in a good place where it won't break, won't be in the way, and will still get a good signal. They could just throw the radio in the back storage bin and perform their other duties in the most minimum of ways. In theory, that fits the definition of doing your job. In reality, that half-assed approach could cost lives. Not 2 hours into that particular mission, we ran into trouble. We touched down at about 0200 hours and began navigating toward our first checkpoint. Our first problem started almost right away, as one of the LTATV engines began to overheat. Great, and also typical. These things can usually go hard for days in the summer heat, and in the middle of the night this happens? We cooled it off and kept going at a slower pace to keep it from breaking down entirely. Then things got really interesting. While moving forward in our unarmored LTATVs, we started taking machine gun fire from a secluded compound that had previously seemed harmless. There was nowhere to take cover. We were in a pretty flat desert area. So the only option was to return fire and maneuver. We hit back with more firepower than they were probably expecting, including 40mm grenade rounds. They were outgunned and quite surprised to see us on their home turf, so they split. As this chaotic situation unfolded, one thing stuck out to me. We were prepared for it. Why? Because everyone did their job. They did their duty. The communications lead made sure that the radio was ready at all times so we could communicate with the air assets. In this case, a Predator drone, instead of just tossing it in the back in case we might need it. And in the middle of a firefight, it is imperative you have comms ready to go at all times. In that moment, everyone had a duty to slow their heart rates and listen for orders. They did that, no problem. Every single team member did their duty to ensure that they would not be the weakest link. Even the smallest thing, like failing to check the batteries in your infrared laser, would mean that you would not be able to aim your gun at night and would therefore be totally useless. The smallest things matter in huge ways. That single 1.5 volt battery is everything. And there is no one to blame but yourself if you don't carry an extra one with you. So maybe you don't have imminent plans to go into battle. That's understandable. But this lesson carries over to your daily life, despite the absence of life or death consequences. Because so what if it's not life or death? Pretend it is. Otherwise, it's easy to fall into the trap of mediocrity. You may survive the gauntlet that we call life, but you aren't really living. And this gets to another common misconception, one that really irks me, about what our duty here on Earth really is, about what living really is. It is the misconception of what it means to live your life to the fullest. In our modern world, full of fun and luxury and comfort, it seems that living life to the fullest increasingly means taking advantage of the modern world's luxuries. Weirdly customized lattes, staying out late drinking with friends, exotic travel, and so on. I don't think there is anything inherently wrong with any of these things. I like all of the creature comforts of the modern world too, but I don't pretend this means living my life to the fullest, far from it. This is a trend that worries me. Teenagers are far less likely to get a job now. Millennials are less likely to work overtime and more likely to value leisure instead of work. Being a millennial myself, I have plenty of experience with this generation and its proclivity for some carefree indulgence. Again, a healthy dose of fun on weekends isn't bad, but it is folly to think that it has anything to do with the purposeful living that we have been talking about. This all ties back to a sense of duty. Do you feel you have any duty to contribute more to this world than you are taking from it? In a world where travel, mixed drinks, and soy lattes are always within reach, does it bother us that our actions don't contribute even a little bit to these modern comforts? Someone dedicated their life to invention, entrepreneurship, and world peace so that you could board an airplane to Europe while sipping a double espresso mocha. What an amazing world we live in. What will we do to earn that luxury? How will we contribute? Answering these questions is an exercise in defining our purpose. When I left the military, I immediately started my master's program at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. One of the oft-repeated mottos of that school is a quote from, you guessed it, John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. It's one of the great lines in American politics, and I swear by it. Stop wondering who is going to create the next best thing to make your life better. Create it yourself. Help your community. I think most of my classmates in that master's program were intent on filling that goal in their own way. That's the good news. But I noticed something else as I transitioned from military to college life, especially with younger students. These kids had great goals and a dizzying array of personal accomplishments to speak of. It is Harvard, after all. But does that mean a sense of duty was really prevalent? Not in the small ways. And as I have argued, the small things matter. I was amazed by how few people actually showed up on time to class, for instance. I was amazed how many people typed away at their laptops, sending iMessages, not taking notes, while the professor tried to lecture. It struck me because it was so normalized in college culture. This lack of politeness and lack of basic manners was the norm, not the exception. Don't get me wrong, the students were not disruptive, but they were at times rude. I couldn't help but think, you are going straight into the job market after this. Who on earth will hire you if you can't show up on time? Maybe I'm just acting like an old grouch, I don't know. But this isn't just my experience. I talk to employers a lot, and I'm often told of management challenges with the younger generation. I'm generalizing here, but there is a growing sentiment that supervisors can't get them to show up on time, and staying late to put the finishing touches on that presentation seems out of the question for them. They think they deserve more responsibility, but aren't willing to start at the bottom in order to earn it. They move between jobs rapidly, thereby making investments in job training a real challenge. There is no sense of loyalty to an organization, no sense of duty to be part of that organization's success. It seems as if they believe the organization has a duty to them, but not the other way around. I accept that this is a perception about a group and that such judgments are often incomplete. The staffers who work for me certainly don't fall into this category of mediocrity, for instance. The good news is this. If you are young and ready to take on the world, engaging in the smallest sense of duty will set you apart. People will notice that you are humble, polite, and believe in the team's success before your own. People will notice that you aren't looking for reasons to be offended, not looking for reasons to be outraged. You will be rewarded for it. In summary, let me end with some lessons in duty to be followed daily. You have a duty to accomplish something every day. You have a duty to live up to your best self, the person you want to be, the hero archetype that you admire. You have a duty to embrace shame and learn from it. You have a duty to be polite, thoughtful, patient. You have a duty to overcome your hardships and not wallow in self-pity. You have a duty to contribute, even if your contribution is small. You have a duty to be on time. You have a duty to do your job, even if your job sucks. You have a duty to stay healthy, both for yourself and so that you do not become a burden on others. You have a duty to be part of the solution, not the problem. In other words, don't join the Twitter mob. You have a duty to try hard not to offend others and try harder not to be offended. We may all survive this great big experience we call humanity if we can abide by some of these little rules. And while I think our country's continued prosperity and even its existence depends on a citizenry that understands and values duty, there is a selfish reason to live a life of purpose and responsibility. It will make you tougher and more successful. We aren't perfect, and we won't always adhere to these basic duties. But I hope we can start to agree on what they are, feel some shame when we fall short, and begin living our lives with purpose. This is the time-tested formula for a stronger people, and more than that, a stronger America. Chapter 8. Do Something Hard. In BUDS, it's all about the next 10 minutes. Sometimes it's about the next 30 seconds. If you are thinking about BUDS in its entirety, 6 brutal months, then the thought is simply too much. The men who quit are the men who look up at the day before them and see all the days to come. They are the men who are miserable and wet and cold and thinking about the hot coffee and girlfriend they miss. And suddenly, because they imagine the months-long suffering they will inevitably face, they break. They are already using every ounce of endurance and fortitude to survive what's happening right now. Expanding their horizons to an infinite number of miserable right nows does them in. So, you focus on the next 10 minutes and remind yourself that the instructors can't kill you, even if they're claiming otherwise. Thousands have made it before you. You can too. What's on the other side when those months and months of 10-minute blocks are over? Liberation, transformation, meaning. I won't suggest everyone go through BUDS, but I will suggest that a life unchallenged by hardship is a missed opportunity, and you should therefore seek to do something hard, something really difficult, something that takes you from a place where you're not the kind of person who could rise to the challenge, to a place where you're the kind of person who did. The achievement isn't necessarily the point. The point is the challenge. The journey is the destination. That's a cliche, but there's a reason it is. It's entirely true. In difficulty, in adversity, in meaningful suffering, there is transformation. That transformation is one of confidence and mental fortitude, derived from the challenge and hardships we seek out. These challenges are forgotten tools, some of life's finest instructors, wiped away by a society that increasingly values comfort and pleasure over accomplishment and triumph. The source of that transformation doesn't have to be BUDS, but for me, it was. I started with Class 261 in August 2006. The first few weeks of BUDS, first phase, are a pure gut check. SEAL instructors want to see if you can push yourself past limits you didn't even know you had. They want you to find inner strength whose existence was hidden before being unveiled by extreme hardship. They want to make sure you will carry your weight in a boat crew, keep up with and lead your class on long runs, endure thousands of repetitions of the same exercise, and do so on sleepless days stacked upon sleepless days. They want to know you will never quit. BUDS is the most effective screening process in the United States Armed Forces, unique in that it doesn't just test physical strength, but also stamina, focus, and raw willpower. It ensures that every single SEAL has the mental fortitude to survive in the worst of environments and still take care of himself and his team. First phase is primarily log PT and IBS training. Log PT, short for physical training, is simple. It means you and your boat crew, about six guys grouped together based on height, carry a log, kind of like a shortened telephone pole, a heavy one, and carry it a lot. There are a variety of exercises that instructors offer up that are generally terrible. Endless lunges while cradling the log, up log, which just means holding it above your head until your arms give out, but mostly, log PT means racing other boat crews up sand berms for hours. Losers keep racing, and winners get to sit out a round. It always pays to be a winner. I still have scars on my inner forearms from cradling the 300-plus pound log while wet and sandy. IBS stands for Inflatable Boat Small, a cumbersome Navy term for what is, in essence, a military river rafting boat. It also weighs 200 to 300 pounds, depending on how much water they have in them. As with the logs, there are a variety of painful games we play for hours on end. We race for miles and miles, carrying the boat on our heads. It is estimated that during Hell Week, we run 200 miles with that sandy rubber atrocity bouncing atop our skulls and pile-driving our spinal cords mercilessly. We take it everywhere with us, never leaving it. That was hard enough. It got harder when my leg, my left tibia to be exact, fractured. This is not a unique injury, of course. Tendinitis and its ensuing limping results in stress on your bone. Stress on your bones eventually breaks them. I spent most of first phase limping around, especially in the early morning when I hadn't warmed up yet. Every day was like that. Hell Week is the fourth week. You have been beaten down for three consecutive weeks, and then you have to stay up for 6 days and go through, well, hell. Hell Week is every SEAL's first real awakening, when you realize the limits you thought you had don't really exist. This awakening gives you the confidence you need to always say, no matter the circumstance, I've been through tougher things before, so why not this too? There is a lesson here. We force hardship upon ourselves because it gives us confidence in ourselves. If I can do this one hard thing, maybe I can also do the next hard thing. Hell Week is an extreme example, but you better believe it builds extreme confidence, sometimes a little cockiness too, which is less of a virtue. Your self-imposed suffering doesn't have to be extreme, but it must be habitual, so that you are in the habit of building up your confidence one challenge at a time. Hell Week is rife with moments of choice, and the choice is always the same: keep enduring the pain or seek comfort. The comfort, the coffee and donuts, are always there, waiting. The instructors never let you forget how easy it is to quit. Hell Week starts on a Sunday and ends Friday. For the first couple of days, you watch as dozens of your friends, some of them in far better physical shape than you, simply give up. They made the choice. They allowed Plan B to become their reality. They probably thought it was a choice all along, and that was the problem. The reason Hell Week is so trying on the human psyche is because it really doesn't ever seem to end. It is the most brutal workout you've ever done, over and over and over again. You reach total muscle failure dozens of times throughout the day. Just when you think the instructors will end an exercise that has broken everybody down, they call for another round. For men who have never experienced failure before, especially star athletes, this can be exceptionally demoralizing. Many think to themselves, I thought I was ready for this. I thought I had trained and prepared. As it turns out, the only real preparation was mental. The preparation happened years before, when you decided a long time ago that this dream wasn't something you could fail at. They would have to kill you or break you. They can't kill you, but they can certainly break you. This was exactly what happened to me. My left leg was getting worse each day. I was moving slower and slower, but still able to pull my weight under the boat we carried everywhere. I had pushed through the pain on one of the worst runs, a seemingly endless 7-mile foot race with the boats on our heads from Coronado to the Imperial Beach Navy Base. We did this on a Sunday night. It felt like we were running forever. It seemed endless. We stopped occasionally to leave our boats and sprint into the frigid Pacific water. After all, the instructors could not possibly tolerate our dry fatigues. Wet and sandy was the standard. By the time dawn arrived, we were greeted by a desolate patch of land covered in sand and ice plants, with plenty of room to continue the boat races. We fueled up with salty MREs, or meals ready to eat, for breakfast, with the just-add-water chemical heating pouches taken out so that we could enjoy the packaged and preserved, quote-unquote, omelets, nice and cold. It was only Monday morning. The air was cold and biting, and the smell of the ocean was already revolting to our senses. The new day reminded us that this demoralizing moment would come 4 more times throughout the week. It was unbearable to some, and they rang the bell as soon as the sun rose. Tuesday came, and we were racing the other boat crews to lunch on a mile-long stretch through the base. At one point, we had to cross Orange Avenue to get from one side of the base to the other. I find it amusing to think of the everyday commuters waiting at the red light and how they must react to the brutal scene playing out in front of them, watching these beaten and exhausted young men sprint across the intersections with sandy rubber boats on their heads. You have to earn your meals during Hell Week, and you earn them by winning the boat races. It pays to give it your all and push your boat crew to victory. Better to put in the effort initially instead of being forced to do another race. The drop in morale that occurs from losing a race is devastating to a boat crew and continues building until the boat crew is exhausted to the point of breaking, unable to perform. The initial pain and effort are worth it. I remember the exact moment when my left tibia snapped. Soon after crossing Orange Avenue, I could feel it as I rounded a corner on our way to the galley. In civilian speak, this is a cafeteria. I kept going. I was not going to fall out of ranks and draw attention to myself. The adrenaline was strong enough to keep me upright. I got my food and sat down. One nice thing about buds is that they don't try and starve you. Quite the opposite. They give you as much food as you need so that you have the calories to keep going. They want you to be healthy and energized because they are pushing your physical limits. They also want you to be healthy and energized because if you quit, they don't want it to be for any other reason than the fact that you chose to quit. I tried to get up from my seat and collapsed back down. The adrenaline had worn off. Something was wrong. I tried again. No luck. Shit. An instructor noticed and said in the most typically unsympathetic voice he could muster, "What the fuck is wrong with you, Crenshaw?" I told him. He responded with the question I knew was coming. "Are you hurt or are you injured?" There is a big difference between hurt and injured. Everyone is hurt. Everyone in that room had something wrong with them. We all had deep and painful chafing from the combination of sand and seawater and our not-so-soft camouflage fatigues, creating the effect of basically wearing sandpaper. Men were swollen and bruised. Many were battling infections and the onset of pneumonia. Everyone was hurt. If you stop because you're hurt, that isn't much different than quitting. I was pretty sure I was injured. I felt my shin snap. Still, the stakes were high. I knew that if they did an X-ray on my leg and it turned out not to be broken, then my entire dream of becoming a SEAL would be shattered. I told the instructor that I was certainly injured. I couldn't put any weight on my left leg at all. As it turned out, I was definitely injured, as the X-ray showed a large crack in my upper left tibia. My time at Buds was done for now, and it was, in the moment, psychologically devastating. Exiting Hell Week involuntarily was never in my plan. A lifelong goal was at risk of slipping away forever. I would have the opportunity to try again, but I would have to watch as my classmates went on to graduate 6 months later, while I was back at ground zero. If you don't make it past Hell Week, you start over. It's like passing a checkpoint in a video game, and I didn't pass it. I had just washed out of the dream I'd chased since I was a boy. Worse, I had washed out for something entirely beyond my control. I could control quitting, but I couldn't control the structural integrity of my left tibia. Worse, I knew that all the suffering I'd been through to get to this point was suffering I'd have to endure again. I knew I had the option, and a perfectly acceptable excuse from the public's point of view, to just opt out of the whole thing. I didn't opt out. I went back. Why? It wasn't because I was superhumanly gifted or unusually tolerant of pain and suffering. I was able to go back and succeed because I availed myself of the tools of a proper mindset. No plan B, remember? I never had a choice except to keep going. I took it 10 minutes at a time. I internalized responsibility without blaming externalities. I understood the value of doing something hard. I never gave myself a choice. 6 months later, I started up again. I was blessed with the benefit of additional training, as those of us who were rolled back to another class would quip. Why do Hell Week once when you can do it twice? I determined that I would have to be killed or broken again to quit. I began again with class 264, and I made it. I went on to second phase to endure the controlled drowning experiences that I relayed to you before. I made it through 5 weeks of isolation on the island of San Clemente, where we did 14-mile ruck runs and shot thousands upon thousands of rounds at the range every day. I graduated Buds. About 8 months later, I graduated from the more advanced SEAL qualification training. I became a SEAL. So you're asking me now, Dan, what did you get out of it? That's a good question. I got a lot out of it. I got a profession I loved. I got brothers who will be my friends for the rest of our lives. I got a small group of men I could trust with anything. That's rarer than it ought to be. I got a chance to serve a country that had given me so much. I got the chance to live according to my purpose. To get all that, I had to earn it. To earn it, I had to suffer. As a consequence of doing something hard, I was rewarded with meaning. It is self-evident that success won through hard work and sacrifice are more appreciated and more meaningful than success simply given. Suffering and hardship, taken on with purposeful intent, lead to a sense of meaning. Finding meaning is what I think Thomas Jefferson meant when he wrote the words, "The Pursuit of Happiness," in the Declaration of Independence. In exchange for the promise that our government shall protect this right, it is expected that our citizenry live responsibly and pursue that which is meaningful. It is rare that something meaningful is found without a degree of hardship. Professor Scott T. Allison, a psychologist at the University of Richmond, writes that the search for meaning not only alleviates suffering, the absence of meaning can cause suffering. Meaning is another antidote to outrage culture. Meaning, purpose, perspective, all these qualities are wrapped up in one another. But they are not gifts conferred, they are earned. The degree of one's hardship is, in the end, a matter of perspective. One man's suffering may be just another easy day for another. When Dirty Jobs host Mike Rowe treks across America highlighting the many blue-collar jobs that are backbreaking, dirty, and exhausting, it goes without saying that many white-collar workers would find that work to be simply too hard. I feel sorry for those white-collar workers who have not had the opportunity to experience the spiritual awakening that comes with truly hard physical labor. I can honestly say that some of my most memorable moments of self-fulfillment were after grueling three-day operations in the mountains of Afghanistan, wading through miles of knee-deep snow, and sleeping in the dirt. There was meaning within the hardship. And it's difficult to describe that meaning. I can only suggest that you do your best to experience it. Not everyone can engage in grueling physical labor, of course. Perhaps your doctor won't let you. But there are other ways to challenge yourself. When I majored in international relations at Tufts University, I also minored in physics. It seems at odds, as the two subjects are so distant. There was also no logical reason to add a bunch of challenging physics classes to my already demanding schedule. I knew I wanted to be a